Now, James the First laid the foundations for the revolution, and I must warn you now that we come to the revolution that you must get your chronology straight, because everything depends on it, as a revolution, like everything else, does not come full-blown like Venus from the shell, but rather also comes from a chronological sequence. And if you get that mixed up, you don't know what is cooking at all. Now, James the First then laid the foundation. How did he do this? As I said last time, by forcing the issues which Elizabeth had left vague and undefined. If under Elizabeth the Puritans were part of the state church, were working within the state church, James expelled them at his famous conference at Hampton Court. He believed, partly wrongly, that they were Presbyterians, and of Presbyterians he had enough in Scotland. In economics, he resorted desperately to extra-parliamentary taxation, and with some success. Indeed, he tried to resort to extra-parliamentary taxation in order to get around calling Parliament, Parliament which already, remember, had a different religious and economic policy from the king. Lastly, in foreign policy, which served to crystallize the issue in many ways, Parliament and James found themselves on different kind of sides. The issue in foreign policy was the 30 Years' War. Listen, I must appeal to you something else as I look at some of you. If you do make this the lunch hour, and my lecture a kind of lunch hour inspirational talk, which I have nothing against, will you please not litter the place with whatever you eat? Because this hall does not belong to us, but to agriculture. And they're only used to littering animals, not to littering people. And I have gotten no end of protests from agriculture. And as agriculture is, for many reasons, a powerful segment of this university, I think better not litter. Now, however that might be, foreign policy was the 30 Years' War. And what did Parliament want? Obviously, to interfere on behalf of the Protestants, to interfere against hated Spain, to support the Palatinate. And this, James thought, would be a grave mistake. For instead, James believed that he could mediate the 30 Years' War, that his relations with Spain were good enough so that he could mediate with Spain and bring the 30 Years' War to a close. Now, politically, James was right in one way and mistaken in another. He was right. The mediation might have helped. But he was mistaken, for England was not as great or important a power that Spain would have to listen to it at all, or the emperor. All that it did was to bring James into the order of Catholicism. Through trying to mediate the war, through not supporting the Palatinate, and remember something here, his daughter was the Countess of the Palatinate. Through not supporting the Palatinate, after all, his son-in-law, of trying to mediate, Parliament began to think that the Stuart dynasty was really Catholic. In this, they were encouraged by the anti-Puritanism, by the road which the Anglican Church now went, the road towards an ever greater ceremonies, towards what Archbishop Laud called the beauty of holiness, towards a kind of, as it seemed to them, pseudo-Catholic church. Now James found that he had to summon Parliament. He couldn't do it all by extra-parliamentary taxation. And once he summoned Parliament, Parliament went on the war path against the king on economics, on foreign policy, and also on religion, which was bound up with all of these. For as one member of Parliament said about taxation, look at the story of Job. What did God do when he wanted to punish Job? He first took away his property, just biblically and incidentally correct. So that taxation was also related in this way to a religion. No taxation, no monopolies. Support the Protestants and all of this. How did James counter it? He countered it in a sense in the worst way possible, by making long speeches about the divine right of kings, which one exasperated member of Parliament described as nothing but the wind. Why did James do it? Because he looked to France, to Richelieu, and he saw Richelieu rebuilding the French monarchy without any estates, without a parliament, and he wanted to imitate, but it was too late. And while James still managed to stave off great unrest simply by dissolving Parliament constantly, his son Charles I was really no longer able to do so, though it looked as if Charles might succeed in doing away with Parliament altogether. For from 1629 to 40, for 11 years, there was no Parliament. Charles I ruled as an absolute monarch, always looking to France. He seemed to have succeeded. And in reality, this success was ephemeral. It was a mirage. He succeeded for 11 years, but the breakdown was total. Why? Because during the reign of Charles, the king was left in the end without any support, without any party that might support him, once he had to call upon Parliament again. And you will see why in a minute. Now, why didn't he have a party? Because in England, the nobility could not be played out against the middle classes. You may remember that the last French Estates General, early in the century, had collapsed, and Richelieu had been able to do his work because the estates were split. The third estates, that is largely the middle classes, were opposed to the nobility, and Richelieu could play out one against the other and thereby defeat the whole business of the Estates General. But in England, the situation was totally different for a reason that I already told you, but I'd better repeat. For the English class structure, there was no such thing as an isolated nobility whose status was different from the rest. There was the nobility, and it was new, because most of the old nobility had been killed off in the Wars of the Roses before Tudor reign ever started. It was new. It had from the beginning dabbled in trade. It had financed the great companies, or helped to finance the great companies for overseas trade, like the Massachusetts Company or the Virginia Company. And it had done that in concert with the merchants of London. There was therefore never this kind of split between the nobility and the merchants. The really powerful nobility was, however, the small nobility, what we call in England the country gentry. These were local nobles, the person who dominated the locality, the village, if you like. They were the unpaid agents of government, the justices of the peace, who really governed the village but who went paid, unpaid, as all government in England was unpaid on that level. So it was the lord of the manor, the justice of the peace, but this gentry again had intermarried with the larger and more powerful gentry, so that there also there were no sharply drawn class differences. There was therefore in England no chance for the king to play off one against another. All he could do is play off his court favorites, but his court favorites were a tiny and not very meaningful section of the nobility. And he faced, in a way, a kind of united front in England, which was never faced, really, on the continent. And second, it might all have worked still if it hadn't been for the vexed problem of Scotland. Now, Scotland had come to England with James I. James I was both King of Scotland and King of England. But the Scotch had kept their system of government, and what is vastly more important, they had kept their Presbyterianism and had not become a member of the Anglican State Church. And this meant that the wild and unruly Scotch nobility, the great Scotch nobles, had in fact been semi-independent. They had by now embraced Presbyterianism. For them by now it was a part of their urge towards independence. In the hill country of Scotland, these great nobles did not want to be ruled from London. London was meaningless in the Scottish Highlands and in the Lowlands as well. James had known this. He understood this. And he left the Scots alone. Just as Charles V, who was born in the Netherlands, had understood the Netherlands and left the Netherlands alone. But Charles I, no longer a Scot, just as, let us say, Philip II was no longer connected with Holland, tried now to do in Scotland what Philip II had tried to do in Holland, and with equally bad results, tried to bring Scotland into line, tried to force upon them the Anglican Church, and try, what nobody ever succeeded, to tame the Scotch nobility. The result of these efforts was something fairly obvious. The Scotch sent deputies, the Scotch revolted. At that moment, Charles had to call Parliament, he had to raise an army, he had to get money against the Scots. And so he had to call Parliament in 1640 in order to get money to put down the Scotch revolt. But now, if you like, to use a commonplace phrase, the chickens came home to roost. For what happened was again obvious and logical. The Scotch got in touch with Parliament and, in effect, told the Puritan leadership in Parliament, we are really on the same side. And the Puritan leadership in Parliament committed what you might really call high treason by allying themselves with the Scots for the good religion against Charles. And at that point, Charles, between the English Parliament and the Scots in alliance together, had no party. And at that point, the civil war properly starts. For though the king had no party, he managed indeed, almost by a miracle, to raise some troops, to import generals from Europe who had fought against the Protestants in the 30 Years' War. And he managed, with some local support, to get the civil war going. But what is important for us to remember, that the English Parliament and the Scots fought together the war against the king. And the English Parliament and the Scots together won this war. Together they won this war. And yet, there is another factor here involved. If these are the political and more than political origins of the English Civil War, it is quite obvious that Parliament and Scots together were not enough to produce a revolution. They produced a civil war. What did they hope to accomplish? What did the Scots in Parliament really want when they went out into the battlefield? Their ideal was what we might call a constitutional monarchy, a monarchy controlled by a Parliament under the dominance of Puritanism. But now Puritanism was being more narrowly defined, for the Scots had exacted a price from the Puritan leadership in Parliament. For that alliance, the Scots had exacted a price, and that price was that after the victory, England must become Presbyterian. Now, why is that so important for everything that follows? For two reasons. First of all, it meant, of course, a definition of Puritanism. That broad impetus of Puritanism was now more narrowly defined. But why? Why? Secondly, Presbyterianism meant order, the avoidance of chaos. For what did Presbyterianism imply? It implied religious discipline. It implied Calvinist religious discipline. And the Parliament and the Scots were agreed in the Civil War that after it is all over, the change would be that the king would remain, but a constitutional monarch, no power of taxation without Parliament, a constitutional monarch, but England would become Presbyterian and would be subject to a rigid Protestant and Calvinist discipline. That discipline would keep the elite leadership in power, would keep the parliamentary leadership in power. That is quite clear. Now, what went wrong? Because as we know, it didn't come out that way. To be sure, Parliament passed the famous Westminster Confessions, the Westminster Confessions, which are the basic document of the Presbyterian Church to this day, the basic document. Parliament passed the Westminster Confessions, accepted also, of course, by the Scots. Rigid discipline, Calvinist discipline, a theocracy in which obviously the parliamentary Puritan leadership all would be on top. Now, what went wrong? Two things went wrong. First of all, and less important perhaps, there was pressure from the countryside. There is no doubt that there was a certain popular pressure, that as far as the countryside was concerned, especially the local gentry, they did not really wish to substitute a Calvinist discipline for Stuart rule. They did not really wish to come under this kind of discipline. No doubt. No doubt. But what went wrong above all else has to do with the army. For the instrument to make a revolution were not the people, but the army. The army which contained the people, the common soldier. Now why? Now why? The most Puritan district of England was the county of Norfolk. The county of Norfolk is that part of England which is nearest to the continent. Why that was so is difficult to say, except that it was in touch with Holland, that there was a lot of commerce back and forth. It is in Norfolk, most Puritan, most anti-monarchical, that the first effective parliamentary troops were raised. These troops were raised as troops were always raised. That is to say, the local gentry would simply impress the peasants. That is to simply would co-opt the peasants into the army. But that local gentry was Puritan. And the man who came to command this army raised in Norfolk was Oliver Cromwell, himself a member of the Norfolk gentry, himself a Puritan of long standing. And it were these Puritans who transformed the army. For once you had a regular and usual 16th and 17th century army, the gentry as officers, especially if they had previous military experience, and some of those had experience in the 30 Years' War, had previous military experience, the peasants as foot soldiers. All right, but the change was this, that the peasants as foot soldiers were treated differently. This is why it was called the New Model Army. It was a new model, but it was based actually on Gustavus Adolphus's victorious army in the 30 Years' War, because Gustavus Adolphus had done something very similar. In order to get the peasants into fighting spirit, in order to convert them to Puritanism, because the gentry wanted to convert, Puritanism was a converting faith, there was attached to every regiment a preacher. That preacher preached regularly to every regiment, preached before battle and preached after battle. He was, if you like, a kind of political commissar to indoctrinate the troops, an indoctrination that was greatly facilitated by the fact that it was a victorious army. For the preaching was always, and I shall come back to that from another angle later, but broadly speaking, the preaching was always that every common soldier was a soldier of Christ and a soldier of God, and that the victory of the arms were the victory of the people of England. The people of England who were God's people, God's chosen people, the nation, the whole nation as the elect, God's chosen people, and that every man, every foot soldier was a member of God's chosen people, and that the victory of the arms showed this, that indeed this was the battle of the elect against Satan. You can imagine what this would do to the consciousness of the common people, the common soldiers in the regiments. You can imagine what this would do, what self-consciousness it would give them, how it would, as you will see in a minute, lead them to say that we are as good as any general, because haven't we been told by our preachers, by the men of God, that every one of us is elect, and every one of us is fighting the war for Christ. It was this army which won the war. The New Model Army, the first, in fact, revolutionary army in history. And it is this army which clashed with Parliament. Why? Two reasons. With Parliament, which was its boss, for whom it fought the war. Two reasons. Parliament was Presbyterian, and it wanted to legislate Presbyterianism for England. And of this, for reasons to which I will come back, the army would have none, beginning with Cromwell down, would have none. Partly because it fastened parliamentary authority upon them, of course. Partly because it firmed this parliamentary leadership. And second, and immediately, and there is always a duller cause for things, Parliament thought of how can we deal with the army, which is a potential danger to us. They did the worst possible thing. They decided the army will be loyal if we pay it by installments. Well, that was a great miscalculation. The army was paid by installments. And this led immediately to Cromwell's invasion of Parliament to Cromwell's discontinuing Long Parliament, as we call this Parliament, because it sat a long time. Long Parliament by force. By force, Cromwell and a few soldiers simply went into the House of Commons and said, you had better go home. And home they went. They will be back later. Now this army, the revolutionaries never win in the long run. This army is perhaps the first revolution. Well, they don't. You always question historical facts. I must remind you, though what I say does not spring directly from God, I am not a New Model Army preacher, though I may tend towards being one at times. Still, there are some historical facts you'd better assimilate. Now this, which you can change, but before you change it, you've got to know them. Now this army is the first revolutionary army in history. And we must look at it closer. Because once Parliament was dismissed, who governed England? What was the only force left? The army. That was the only force left. We must look at this army a little further. For in the army, the very broad base of Puritanism, which I have told you about before, that very broad base comes into evidence. For the Puritanism of Norfolk was not a Presbyterianism. Very little of English Puritanism had been a Presbyterianism. It was indeed a kind of pietism. But once the war started, the doctrine of election lay at hand. As you see, quite obviously, if you're going to raise an army to fight the king, you're going to oppose the divine right of the army to the divine right of kings. You're going to accentuate election against the king, obviously. And that idea of election was always inherently dangerous in encouraging radicalism. For after all, let us be clear about this. Once you talk to people that you are the elect, the line between election and perfection is very thin. And it proved so, obviously, in reality. Calvin had believed outward discipline was necessary to keep this line, election and perfection. For Calvin, they were not the same, remember, at all. And therefore, you had to have discipline, something that is reflected in these Westminster confessions. But the army, through this emotional preaching in front of these regiments going off to battle and to be killed, through this emotional preaching, obviously didn't draw that line. God gave them victory. Revelation, and you will read it in your source book, Revelation had removed the stigma of sin for every ordinary soldier included. For this was the army of the elect, the army that had the direct revelation, not the divine right of kings, but that army had the direct revelation. The army preachers preached the equality of all saints before God and all of those who fought the battle for righteousness were saints. Notice, the equality of all before God, not before men. Small wonder that the army came to regard itself as an elite, as the elect, as over against the parliamentary leadership, which seemed to have sold out, which looked for a constitutional monarch. And how could you compromise with Satan? The parliamentary leadership not only didn't give them their pay as they should, but they also seemed to have sold out. For after all, you couldn't compromise with Satan, not after having won the battle. Oliver Cromwell shared some of these beliefs. He undoubtedly shared the belief that officers and men were united against the world of Satan, that the officers and men together of this elite must rebuild England. in the image of the godly society. The result of this is most important and indeed revolutionary. For every regiment now that the war was won, elected representatives. They called them agitators, but that word in the 16th century means representatives. Every regiment and the officers elected representatives. And the officers and the soldiers' representatives met together, face to face, in free debate, in order to determine the future of England. This is the beginning of a new phenomena, which you know simply under a Soviet title, the Soviets of Soldiers' Deputies. But that is really what this is, these meetings. They are the Soviet of Soldiers' Deputies meeting together in these councils, calling themselves agitators. They met together in a church. Those were the only meeting places. In a little church, in a little village near Saffron Walden, notice again, in Norfolk, in the village church of a place of Saffron Walden. And I just mention this for a reason that as American tourists always want to see the origins of things in Europe, if you want to see the origins of most modern democratic and liberal ideas, don't go to the Parliament of Westminster. That's beside the point. The origins lie in the parish church in Saffron Walden, where the officers and soldiers' deputies met and discussed. These debates are called the army debates, but they are much more. They are debates then, the first debates in which the common people were involved on an institutional basis, you might say, elected by their peers, other common people. But not, of course, all common people, only those who served in the regiments, a small minority of common people. Only those who served in the regiments, only those who had belonged to the Puritan side. The result was, of course, an outburst of radicalism. As one foot soldier put it, every poor man who is willing that the Commonwealth shall flourish has a real hand here, a hand as real as that of the greatest divine. The problem in these army debates already is coming to light. Cromwell countered, "We are apt to call that faith which is but carnal imagination." Another common soldier said, "Well, here we are. All right, we can decide what we want, but I'm not going to be satisfied. I'll go ever further. No contract you make here can bind me, because I have to follow every revelation God gives me. I'm going further and further." And Cromwell again replied, "How can you have ordered society? How can we settle England on this good Puritan ground of what we call progressive revelation?" In other words, these debates raised at once the problem of how feasible it was to settle England on a radical base, which seemed to threaten a chaotic individualism and the idea of constant revelation, which is, of course, part of this chaotic individualism, which seemed to defeat all ordered society. And Cromwell's fight in these army councils was, of course, to tame this radicalism so that he could get one way to rule England, so that he could get a society and a rule going. Now, what ideas did this radicalism express? For that, for us, is in a sense of prime importance. As I have told you before, here are the roots of modern democratic thought. Here are the roots of democratic thought For this radicalism expressed lots of things. For the first time, you have a huge outpouring of it. You have it in the peasants' wars. You have it before and during the revolution. But here it is channeled. The important thing is, there was a protocol taken. We know every word that was spoken. For this was to be an assembly to reorder England. This was not just some vague kind of meeting. This was a structured assembly, so that we have every word spoken and indeed published, even in paperback. You can read it. This might be your answer. You might find yourself. I don't know where you find yourself, as good as any place, I guess. Wodehouse called Puritanism and Liberty. But what this Puritanism and Liberty is the transcript of these debates. Now, what do we find there? What do we find there? And I will make a slight change in our format, because I think it is better if I stop a little more early next time and finish that this time, so that you get the whole picture. So I won't stop 10 minutes early this time, but I will stop earlier on Wednesday, so that you have the whole picture. What do we find? What principles did the soldiers express? To be sure, the soldiers expressed the ultimate assumptions of democratic thought: individualism, natural rights, fundamental law. As you will see, in no way, this is the ancestry of a kind of liberalism. So you will see, in very little ways, is it an ancestor of what you might kind of call kind of socialism. Let us look at these much closer now, because they will become very important. First of all, what about the individualism? The idea here is, of course, rather simple, that all must have a say in government. From the beginning, you get the urge for universal suffrage. And you can see why. You can get the idea opposed to entrenched privilege. You can see why. Secondly, the idea of natural rights, that man has certain natural rights which nobody can take away. What are these rights? Well, again, they come out of the immediate situation. The prime right is the right to free conscience. Because after all, they had been preached to so long that everyone is equal to God. There must be the priesthood of all believers. If you are the elect and you have just won the battle for the Lord, obviously your conscience is as good as Mr. Cromwell's and a hell of a lot better than Charles I's. Thus we get for the first time the advocacy of toleration on a theoretical rather than on a practical basis. Political realism had dictated the limited toleration which we have in the Edict of Nantes. That had been dictated, remember, by political realism. But here you have it on a practical basis, but limited. Who wasn't tolerated? Well, obviously the enemies of the Lord. Nobody thought of tolerating them. Who were the enemies of the Lord? The Catholics, clearly. The Church of England, clearly. And the atheists. I shall come back to what they called atheism a little later. But the Catholics, the Church of England, the atheists were excluded. These are the people you'd been fighting. So that when they called our liberty of conscience, it was liberty of conscience in the terms of the revolution, and not complete liberty of conscience as we might perhaps conceive it. Thirdly, they put forward, and this is of vast importance, the idea of fundamental law, of a written constitution. A written constitution which would include those matters to be exempted from all government: toleration, free speech, free assembly, universal suffrage. Now why? Why would they be so hept on fundamental law? Because this seemed to them one way to institutionalize their revolution. This seemed to them one way to get away from the arbitrariness, of Stuart government, the 11 years where Charles had ruled without parliament, the equal arbitrariness of parliament, which had tried to impose a Presbyterian constitution upon England. What was more logical than to have a written document so that these things would never happen again? A written document which enshrined the aims of the army, or as the common soldiers saw the army, the aims of toleration, free speech, free assembly, and universal suffrage. What then was the mainspring for all of this? No doubt you will see that more in a little while too. This was religious, not secular radicalism. They did not start in any way, and you have the debates to prove it, from their secular ideas of oppression. They started straight away in the army debates from what you would call, and not astonishingly, a religious framework into which they put their secular grievances. There can be no doubt about this. It is the Bible that is fundamental. It is the Protestantism of the priesthood of all believers. And these ideas are translated into the terms of democracy against privilege. They revive the ancient Christian doctrines of criticism against acquisitive society. And they push these ancient Christian doctrines to the length of democracy. Their program, obviously, doesn't allow a distinction between religious and secular. And you can make out a point that their approach did not mean that distinction either. They had not entered the New Model Army for a secular reason. The preaching of the army chaplains is singularly free from calls to secular revolution. Many of them knew better. But as they made a call to spiritual revolution and spiritual equality, this was soon translated to secular equality. But you will not find it in the preaching, in much of the preaching of the so-called army chaplains. You have, therefore, a revolutionary impetus within the same framework that you had it in the peasant rebellion of 1527, a framework which does not allow you to make clear distinctions between secular and religious, but whose ideological justification, and that means the justification of thought and attitude, springs from millennial Christian ideals and not any purely secular ideals. That was unknown even when we come to the diggers, to whom we shall come in a minute, who did believe in a great deal of rationalism. Now it is true that Cromwell was not without sympathy for most of these points. But he found himself in a bind that's logical. With these radicals, whom we shall classify in a minute, you couldn't rule England. You couldn't do anything with them. What are you going to do with them? How are you going to rule something with a guy who tells you, I'm not bound by any contracts, and when I have a new revelation, I'll do anything else? You can't do anything with these people, except what Cromwell did eventually, shoot them down. Not really very much, but, you know, he shot a little and they went away, you see. But you couldn't really settle England on this kind of a basis. Now, what did Cromwell attack most of all? He attacked manhood suffrage. This, typically enough, from his point of view, he deemed most dangerous for the religious radicalism, translating itself into action. He talked constantly in trying to stem the radical tide. He talked constantly about having a stake in England. What did he mean by that? Having land. He tried, typically enough, to counter this radicalism with what you might call semi-feudal notions, that only those should have a say in England who had land in England. What this meant, translated in historical reality, meant, of course, the gentry. That is one way, and the main way, in fact, he tried to really counter this kind of radicalism. Let us ask us for a minute, was there any justification for his fear of democracy? And to say that in more detail, let us give two examples of this radicalism with which he had to cope in the army debates, but also out of the army debates. One example concerns what we call the Fifth Monarchy Men, a fairly big group. These are people who believe that the Fifth Monarchy, this is another way of putting the millennium, the Fifth Monarchy of Christ was about to arise. These Fifth Monarchy Men were a sizable group with whom he had to deal. And this was, by and large, the group that thought you couldn't be bound by any contracts because God would give you a new revelation every month, every day, some of them, I think, every hour watching these debates, and therefore there could really be no contracts made. The second, not as important then as they are now, a small group, but an interesting group worth talking about, were what you would call communitarians. You can call them utopian communists, but that judges them. That judges them from an irrelevant point of view. We better call them communitarian communists. Associated with the name of Gerald Winstanley, people who were also then called diggers, because they simply were squatters. They moved wherever they want to and dug up the land because the land should belong to everybody. They were also an important group. And lastly, we must add, I think, a third group of some importance, those moderates who were called the levelers. It is the levelers whom I have described to you so far. It is the levelers who wanted the fundamental constitution. It is the levelers who wanted freedom of conscience and all of that sort of thing. It is the levelers whom I have, by and large, described for you. But besides these people called levelers, because people thought they wanted to level things, but besides these levelers, there are these other two revolutionary groups, the Fifth Monarchy Men and the Utopian Communists, to whom we must give some attention. I suppose, however, when looking over above this whole revolution, that one of the main things about it was the First Revolutionary Army, the first representative institution which the common men took part in, which represents these army debates in Suffren Walden, and the very fact that these things took place, that these things happened in one point in history, are, I think, for us, of the greatest importance. I'll go on with that next time.